Your check, your cooperative. As a farmer-owned lender, Farm Credit Mid-America shares the success of the cooperative with our customers, which is why we've returned more than $1.5 billion back to our customer owners over the last 9 years. It's proof being a part of our cooperative pays. Patronage is an annual decision made by the board of directors to return earnings to eligible customers. To learn more about patronage and eligibility, visit fcma.com/patronage.
Pitchfork, light your torch, and get ready for inciting a riot. Conventional thinking has been warned, because we're going to gather, and we're going to march, and we're going to blow its f***ing house down.
Hello, rioters, and welcome back to Inciting a Riot, the podcast. I would be your left-wing, dirt-worshipping host, Firelight. Have you ever seen those food videos on YouTube where a chef or a food scientist tries out a series of food hacks, I'm using air quotes here, found in those viral videos by places like 5-Minute Crafts or Blossom? The hacks, as they're commonly called, showcase a new, easier way of cooking in well-edited videos lasting only a few seconds per recipe. Ostensibly, this is to help folks who don't have a lot of cookware on hand or prior skill make something delicious in a way that's cheap, accessible, and easy. Making brownies in a paper bag or caramel corn with a bit of candy and some kernels. These videos are made in a way that most people find not only aesthetically pleasing, but enjoyable to watch and rewatch, to share with their friends, and of course, to try and replicate. Some of the biggest channels on YouTube are these life hack or food hack videos, garnering hundreds of millions of views across multiple channels and raking in large sums of money for the never-seen owners of the channel. Invariably, what the chef or food scientist realizes pretty quickly is there is a problem, several actually, with these slick, trendy videos. There are no lists of ingredients used, no temperatures provided, no times given, and no narrator telling you what they're doing. So when the expert attempts to replicate the video, they immediately run into some problems and typically need a fire extinguisher on hand. The food scientist or experienced chef can usually break down exactly why the hack doesn't work as they're showing you the technique used in the viral video. Either the recipe is missing a key ingredient that would cause the bread to rise, or the video tells you to use something that would fall apart in real life. What is most often the case is, if you look closely, the videos are edited in a way that the end result is an already prepared dish that wasn't made using the hack. What does this have to do with a podcast about witches and other magical people? Well, we have similar issues with trendy viral videos. Except, in our case, they typically come in the form of supernatural claims, ghost hunting videos, and the broad-reaching world of paranormal entertainment programs. In these videos, you might see a person performing a feat of magic or displaying a supernatural ability, such as walking on water or fire, as proof of their gifts. In other videos, you might hear an investigator give long, detailed explanations about all of their technical equipment and how it will prove or disprove the presence of a ghost or other being. While many people online making recipe videos or showing off life hacks, or, as is the case in our topic today, hunting ghosts, are doing it in good faith, there are a few, I want to stress that here, a few out there that aren't, and they tend to be the most visible. Going viral is a goal for a lot of people putting content online. It represents the chance to be seen by millions of people and to suddenly experience fame, receive a financial windfall, or accrue a legion of adoring fans hanging on their every word. Some people seek all three of those, some only one, but in either case, what they're usually seeking isn't to provide a legitimate good or service to the world, but to increase their own standing in it. This distinction is important because it illustrates that the person's motivation might end up causing harm on you, the end user. Harm can look like a lot of things. If you don't know how to temper chocolate properly or how to handle it, you can do anything from destroy your cookware to need a trip to the ER to treat a burn. Likewise, if you're not cautious, a bad faith paranormal entertainer might take your time, money, or worse. Kenneth Biddle joins a long line of people who investigate big claims of the possibly paranormal. Like his Mythbusters predecessors, Biddle employs a knowledge of scientific research, fact-checking, and common sense in his attempts to provide context and reasoning for some of the bigger, more outlandish claims of the paranormal floating around the internet today. He is my guest today in a long, important discussion about the science behind ghost hunting, the tools used and misused by paranormal entertainers, the spectrum of potential harm, and, of course, cryptids. Enjoy my conversation with Kenneth Biddle. Kenny Biddle, welcome to Inciting a Riot. Glad to have you here, sir.
Hey, how you doing?
Doing well, doing well. I'm a little jealous of the room that you're in. It is chock full with all sorts of fun goodies. I love the Ghostbusters memorabilia.
Oh my goodness. There's so much more. I have a basement full of stuff that's allegedly haunted items that people have given me over the years. And I have two ghost traps. I have my PKE meter. I have my Zenner cards from Ghostbusters 2. Or Ghostbusters in the beginning, the first one. So lots of stuff. And I'm a total geek.
I appreciate an unabashed nerd. I am the angle in which I am in is this is the one wall in this entire room that has nothing in it. The rest of it is still memorabilia. It's just this is the only one that I get any light in.
Look, here you go.
Wait a minute.
Oh man.
There's stuff all over there.
Let's see. We'll do the thing.
Oh, there you go.
Yep.
Oh, nice.
And then I've got all my comic encyclopedias and things over there. So, and other than geeking out over one another's spaces, you're here today because you are a paranormal poker of things. You poke paranormal concepts. For folks that don't know you and your work, and for people listening to this show, they probably don't, because a lot of the audience for this show comes to paranormal claims, spiritual modalities, things like that, from a place of belief and not necessarily from a place of skepticism. However, I personally do enjoy having lots of discussions about skepticism and the notion of sort of poking the bear, as it were. So for folks that don't know you and your work, tell folks a little bit about yourself.
All right. So I did start out as a ghost hunter back in the 90s. I was part of a ghost hunting team. I went out, I did everything pretty much you see on the TV shows. And then I got into photography. So I got into it as a hobby at first because of ghost hunting, and then did it professionally for several years, where I was doing weddings and different parties and corporate events, all kinds of stuff like that. And the more I learned about photography, the more I understood that a lot of the stuff people were getting, including myself, were simple mistakes. So I kind of moved on from the ghost hunting to more of the skeptical side and reading the scientific literature and the skeptical literature on the topics. And the more I learned, the more I just took off with that. So I started a blog where I would just talk about different anomalies. I would talk about different methods, and that morphed into a YouTube channel where I dissected ghost hunting equipment, like taking it apart, showing you what's inside, what it really does. And that morphed into further stuff writing for Skeptical Inquirer, and they offered me my own column. I went out to SciCon four times to do workshops for them in Las Vegas, where I was teaching people how to deconstruct alleged paranormal photography and video, how to solve mysteries. And that just keeps growing. I keep doing more lectures and more talks on this kind of stuff. I do two podcasts on paranormal topics, where one is a Q&A show on Friday nights, where I just take paranormal questions and we talk about it. We have a discussion. No fighting or anything like that. We just talk and we have a discussion, and I give more of a skeptical science point of view and try to figure out what might be going on. And then another show I do Saturday nights with two other guys, and we usually pick a topic, and as I like to say, we science the shit out of it and just we just go for it. You know, we come at a topic from three different perspectives, and it really flows nicely. So that's what I do. I also set up a booth at paranormal events. I set up a skeptical booth, which looks like, if you ever seen Peanuts, and I'll show you a little thing. So Lucy's stand, I have one of these that's full-sized that says skeptical help bar, and I set it up at paranormal conferences.
Do you charge people 5 cents?
I actually put out a bucket, a can that looks like Lucy's can, and it's for donations. And all donations go to the Cancer Research Institute. So whatever they want to donate is fine. It goes in the can, and then I donate it when I get home.
Do you ever get rotten fruit in that donation can?
I get rotten looks sometimes. No rotten fruit, but once in a while, I get a nasty look or a nasty comment, just because I'm pretty much a goldfish in a shark tank when I go to paranormal conventions. But I mean, it's not really that bad. So that's me in a nutshell.
So I'm curious. The concept of expertise is weird. I did an entire show earlier this year. It was a panel discussion about just sort of the concept of being an expert. What makes someone an expert? How do you identify an expert? And how do you tell when somebody is you know, calling themselves an expert that shouldn't be? So you call yourself in your bio a science enthusiast. I'm curious, what makes you the expert on debunking? Because I think that there are people on the other side of this conversation that would call them themselves experts in paranormal investigation. So I suppose, you know, what makes your expertise the superior expertise, or what makes you the expert, period?
Well, see, that's the thing. Like, I really don't use the word expert when I talk about myself, because I still have trouble looking at myself as an expert. Mm-hmm. And that's why I don't refer to myself that way. I refer to myself as a science enthusiast because I'm enthusiastic about science. I read about it. I love to go to conferences and learn more. I watch science programs constantly on YouTube. So when it comes to my expertise, I have some expertise in photography because I have 15, 20 years experience in it. I know the tricks. Mm-hmm. I read about it constantly. I have an entire, well, two bookshelves full of manuals for different photography techniques, ranging from old school film fakery, like when you had old like political propaganda and military propaganda, when they would retouch photos, learning how to do that, all the way up until modern times, where you're using editing software like on your phone, where it takes two clicks and you have a ghost in your photo. Mm-hmm. You know, so I have put the time in the research and the time learning. So I do think I have expertise in that area. When it comes to everything else, I'm giving an opinion. Mm-hmm. You know, I don't consider myself an expert. I'm giving an opinion. I'm looking it up. And I think that's the difference between just saying that someone's an expert and actually doing the work. And we don't see a lot of that today. We see a lot of people base what their expertise is on watching a TV series. You know, like, oh, I watched 12 seasons of Ghost Adventures, so I know what I'm doing. And my first response is, no, you don't.
Though I do think that would make you an expert in the size of Zach Bagans' black t-shirts. That guy wears tighter clothes than I do, and that is saying something. So,
yeah, I mean, you can be an expert on like show topics and what they've done, where they've gone, you know, but you're not an expert in investigating claims. And sometimes you can tell someone that claims to be an expert is not an expert, especially when I'm dealing with photographs or video, and you start asking questions. And one of the easiest questions you can ask when you see a photo of an alleged ghost, say like an apparition. So mm-hmm. you get this like shadowy figure that's kind of blurry. And the first question I ask is, what was the exposure time? Mm-hmm. And when they look at you like, what do you mean? And that's one of the simplest questions you can ask anyone that's a photographer. Like, what's the exposure time? What's the shutter speed? Was the flash fired? You know, stuff like this. And when they look at you with a confused look, you know instantly they have no clue what they're talking about. And that's usually where I base it off of, like, all right, you're not an expert in this. Okay. And again, I'm not saying I am. but I do have some knowledge in this. And I know enough to know I don't know everything.
Yeah, I love one of your examples that you gave on your website. There was a photo of a group of young women that all worked in some kind of textile factory or something like that. And there was a floating hand on someone's shoulder. And it goes around in lists of, like, oh, you know, there's a floating hand. And then there's, you know, stories that people try to attach to it that aren't ever able to be fully corroborated. Like, oh, you know, there's a dead girl in the factory, or there was this, or there was that, and it's her hand. And you're like, no, this is just early Photoshop. This is just... what we do. So maybe explain that photo and a little bit of how, you know, sometimes some of those photos that we see going around aren't what we think they are.
Well, yeah, I mean, it's a trend. It's easy to share stuff now without verifying, without checking your facts. It's very easy to share things, especially if you already believe in the paranormal and you have a strong belief. As soon as you see a ghost photo, a quote unquote ghost photo, you share it. You're like, look at this, check this out. But with that example, with this floating hand, this ghostly hand, it was taken in 1900, and it was, it was a textile factory. The women were gathered together. They were showing off they had not necessarily uniforms, but all the same kind of dress and top. They had a rope belt with their tools hanging from it. And in one side of the photograph, there is a hand on a shoulder that doesn't belong to anyone. You can account for everyone's arms and hands, and pretty much every woman is standing like this. They have their arms folded. So you're like, all right, what's going on here? And I mean, yeah, like you said, the stories go around where it's like, oh, there was a factory worker and she died right before the picture was taken, but she still wanted to be in the photo and stuff like that. But when you start looking deeper into it, when you take the time and you find the original photo, that's important. You find an original high-res copy because, well, the original photo is from 1900, and I think there's only one that's in existence. But you look at that, you start looking at all the details of the women around it, and you realized, well, at least I realized, that there was parts that were drawn in. So part of the woman's face where the hand appears, one side of her is actually drawn in. The hair is drawn in. Her sleeve, not the inside, but the outside where someone might be standing, was drawn in. And they do that with Indian ink. They do it with charcoal. They also, there's a thing called a retouching desk, which is the old school way to Photoshop. And it was like this contraption that unfolded. It was a piece of wood, a couple pieces of wood that unfolded. You put it next to a window because we're talking time where not everyone had electric lights, and the sunlight would come in, reflect off of a mirror on the bottom of it, and shine through an opaque piece of glass where they would put the glass plate of the photograph, because they also didn't have negatives. It was a glass negative,
daguerreotype. Isn't that what that's called?
Yeah. So they would take that and they would scrape away some of the ink in order to make modifications. So most likely, And this is speculation on my part based on what I see in the photo, most likely that woman was just removed for some reason. Either she was fired or maybe she did die. And they're like, well, we're not going to have a picture of her because she doesn't work here anymore, which is kind of morbid. Or
she broke protocol. Her arms were not folded.
Exactly. Like, what was she doing? Maybe she just jumped into the photo and like, hey, you know, I'm going to be in here. For some reason, they wanted her out, so they literally removed her. And you could do that. You could do it. You scrape away, especially because she was on the end of the photo. Mm-hmm. It was easy to scrape away her image and then redraw the dress of the woman behind her. Much easier to do that. Taking the hand out would have taken a little bit more work.
Yep.
So instead, they just left it in there. And I mean, for over 100 years, no one noticed. Nobody noticed it until they posted it on a website for the region where it was taken. And somebody spoke up and said, hey, there's an extra hand there. And then it became a sensation. But I mean, when you look at things closer, you usually find an answer.
What does the word scientifical mean?
That is a term. I first heard that with Sharon Hill. And she's a great, great researcher. And it basically, from what I gather, it means you're trying to be scientific by sounding scientific, but you're not. It means you don't have a good understanding of the terms that you're using. You don't have a good understanding of the techniques that are involved, the methods that are involved. And you're basically pretending to be scientific, and you're not. And it applies to a lot of ghost hunting teams, a lot of Bigfoot teams, a lot of UFO researchers. It applies to a lot of them. And granted, I mean, some of them are really trying, but I think they get stuck on this attitude of, well, this is good enough. And you can't be good enough when it comes to science. You need protocols in place to guard against any kind of contamination. You need experimental controls to control all the variables. When you take pictures, you need control of the environment, the lighting. When you're recording sessions, you need control of all the sound in the area and be aware of things outside and people talking and what people are wearing. There's so much involved. And I feel that, again, I'm going to pick on ghost hunters, that when they go to an allegedly haunted place, they go in there and they say, well, we know our team, so that's good enough. I trust members of my team, so that's good enough, which it's not, because people fuck around all the time. it's just not good enough. So scientifical is used to describe people that are like that. When they think things are good enough, they think they know science, they think they know the methods and protocols, but they don't do them.
Sounds like it's one of those terms akin to what Stephen Colbert's truthiness. It's yeah. true because I want it to be true.
Yes.
It feels yeah. true. It's truer than true.
It's scientific because I want it to be scientific.
Yeah. And yeah. There's been this trend for a few decades now where people take beliefs in the paranormal and magic and magical thinking and that kind of thing and try to dress it up. I don't know why that is. I mean, I'm curious about your perspective. I genuinely don't know. I come to belief from a place of just, believing and understanding that it is a belief that doesn't require evidence. But there are quite a number of people that do try to hold on to debunked studies and experiments that can't be replicated and, you know, alleged laws of the universe that are not actual laws. You know, I think we're all still living in the fallout of Emoto and those Rice experiments and what the bleep do we know and the law of attraction and stuff like that. But I'm just curious from your perspective, sort of as an outsider to belief, from a skeptic's perspective, what do you think that a spiritual person is grasping for there in that confirmation bias?
You said it, a confirmation bias, you know, I mean, that's it. They're remembering the hits and forgetting the misses. That's pretty much standard. And I think the idea of using studies that have been debunked or retracted or using information that has been shown to be false, still using that kind of information is partly because that's what they know. That's what they've been pretty much basing their beliefs on for so long that they're used to it. It's part of their core belief. Part of it is also because I think, and this is again speculation on my part, but I think it's because they hope you don't look it up. If they can throw some science word salad at you and maybe overwhelm you with so much, like this study said this and this study did this, and how do you know this? How do you prove this? How do you debunk this? When they shotgun or machine gun stuff at you like that, you don't have time to look it up. You know, and when I'm in that situation, I usually like stop. I tell them stop. We need to go one by one. If you're going to throw 20 things at me, this conversation's over. I'm done. I'm not going to talk to you, you know, but if you want to go one by one, we can look this up and we can confirm like what's your problem with point number one. Let's look at that, you know? And I think that's why they hold on to these beliefs. It's for validity. You know, they think part of a study or part of a documentary, or, oh my God, I hate when they do this, part of a YouTube video, you know, and they're like, oh, this YouTube video proves everything that I'm going to say. When they use that and they throw it at you, they are using that as that's validity. That is confirming, that's confirmation of their belief. And so there, and they're throwing it at you and saying, debunk that, debunk this. How do you explain this? When
I like when it's, here's my proof, and then they send you to either a blog or a YouTube video, and then they then that blog or YouTube video links to their source, which is another blog or YouTube video, and then you get, you know, if you go back far enough, sometimes it's even just like a joke tweet that somebody took way out of context and then spun off, and people took too seriously, and 10 years later it's like, oh, here's proof, look at all these other videos. All these other videos are out there about this, that must mean there's something to it. And right. I think that's kind of the thing. Like when people throw enough like half science at things, when people throw enough half studies at things, they say, well, there's a bunch of talk about it. It's very Trumpian. A lot of people are talking about this.
Yeah.
There must be something true to it.
Right. And that's a fallacy.
It is. Yeah. Yeah. There's that blinding you with science, right?
Yeah. Yeah. I mean, if you throw enough at them, you're like, oh, well, everyone knows this, or everyone is talking about it. That doesn't mean it's true. We have to break it down. We have to look at it and say, all right, is there any fact to this? Is there any basis for this statement? Let's look at this. Another thing is taking quotes out of context, or giving you partial quotes. And yeah. I can't stand that. I hate that. Einstein is one of the most popular. Like I constantly hear, energy cannot be created or destroyed. It can only change forms. And there's so much more to that quote. You have to read about it and realize, like, wow, there's not just that little part that you keep repeating 1,000 times a day. There's a lot more to that. And you have to read up on it and realize, like, it doesn't mean that ghosts are real just because you can't create or destroy energy. It changes forms. Yeah, it changes forms. It becomes heat energy, or it becomes food for something else, some other creature. It changes the forms in that way. And I mean, a lot more, it's a lot more involved than just that. I'm oversimplifying the idea, but ghost hunters love, and paranormal enthusiasts across the board, especially conspiracy theorists, they love taking part of a quote and latching onto it and saying, look, this famous person or this scientist, that's even better, this scientist said this. And that's why, like, for me, references, citations are so important, because I want to know where you got that quote so I can read the rest of it. Especially mm-hmm. when people do proper publications and put the dots in, meaning like, all right, there is more to this quote. What's that say? And when you read the extra like two words, sometimes it can completely changes the context of the quote, and you're realizing, well, you know, that person actually said the opposite of what you're promoting. So maybe you should, you know, do your research.
It's so, like, everybody knows that famous verse from the Bible, Jesus wept, but they don't realize that the rest of the quote is Jesus wept because Chipotle was out of guac that day. And if they just knew that, feel like...
That's a good one.
It's fine. People can write their emails. I want to ask, just because I kind of want to get a measure of, I know that you started off being a ghost hunter, good faith ghost hunter in the 90s. I'm curious, do you have anything that you would consider personal spiritual beliefs of your own?
No. No.
Did you at one time?
So I was raised Catholic.
Okay.
That's what I was raised. And I had that belief, that guilt.
How's the guilt going? Do you have a lot of it still?
There you go. Yes.
Is there a bucket where you keep your guilt?
Well, not anymore. I dumped that out years ago. You know, I had that guilt. I grew up with it. You know, you don't go to church. It was like the end of the world. The apocalypse was coming if I was sick and I couldn't go to church. But yeah, I grew up that way. I would say, like, in my teenage years, high school years, I started doubting then and trying to do little things where, like, well, if I didn't go to church, what would happen? you know, I'm getting told that, you know, bad things will happen and I'll feel terrible. And, you know, I think the feel terrible thing was more or less, am I going to get caught? You know, and once I started not going, I realized nothing was happening. I wasn't getting struck by lightning. Bad luck was not coming my way. There was not a portal to hell opening up in front of me where I would fall in. So I thought, you know, I think I'm okay. I'm good. So yeah, I had those kind of beliefs, but I've since just abandoned every belief. I don't like the concept of belief. I go with the, if you ever saw Dogma by Kevin Smith, I love that film. I love that movie. Oh, I love the film. And
I have chosen to believe that Alanis Morissette is actually God. And that's, there has been no proof to the contrary, so it must be true.
Oh, well, you know, we're talking about that kind of thing.
There you go.
You're good to go. You're good. But when Rufus comes along, and he talks about the idea of ideas, you know, don't have beliefs, have ideas. The first time I saw that, I was like, boom, the light bulb went on. I was like, that's a beautiful concept. I love that. And that's the way I'm going to go. I have ideas. Ideas are so much easier to change with new information. When you get new information, you decide, okay, you know what? I think this new information is good, or this new information is bad. Either way, it's easier to change that idea. When you have these beliefs that you've had since you were a child, since you can remember things, it's so hard to break away from them. I mean, I remember being in that spot where I was like, all right, I'm not going to church. That first time, I'm not going to church. I went to the playground because it was on the way to church. And I was like, I'm going to stay here. I'm hiding. This big wooden structure inside this playground. I'm hiding inside, sweating because I'm so nervous and I'm scared because I think something really bad is going to happen. Nothing happened. And I was like, wow, okay. All right. I can do this. So breaking away from that idea or that belief was so hard. It caused anxiety, especially in a little kid. It caused so many problems. So I decided I'm done with beliefs. I don't have beliefs. So I don't believe in any God or gods. I don't believe in the afterlife. I don't believe in demons or devil or hell and stuff like that. But I have ideas. Like, I think it might be possible for there to be an afterlife, but I haven't seen any proof of it. I haven't seen any evidence. So that's pretty much
why you became a ghost hunter, to try to go find that evidence?
Yes. Yeah, I wanted to see, because I didn't realize this was the 90s. So the internet was brand spanking new. Mm-hmm. It had just become available for
gotta love the those GeoCities websites where they're spinning GIFs.
God.
All the flaming eyeballs. When AOL. People got to figure out how to do that.
Yeah. Yeah. Figuring all that stuff out. And I realized, like, wow, there's so much more out there. And then I realized that there were people that were actively going to haunted locations to see what they could get. And I was like, wow. Oh, wow. There's one in my area. Oh, wow. I can join it. Woo! This is great. Let me go see. Let me tag along. So that's the start of my ghost hunting days, where I went out to cemeteries. I went out to abandoned hospitals. I went out to historical places like Fort Mifflin in Philadelphia, stuff like that, where I was like, all right, there's ghost stories associated with it. And I read the ghost stories. And that was probably the worst thing I could do, because I primed myself for seeing ghosts or hearing ghosts. So
if you're told there's a ghost in the attic and yes, it makes a certain noise, then you're going to go to the attic and you're going to be primed to hear yep, that noise, and you're exactly, going to attribute it to a ghost.
Exactly. And that's what I did. Yep. And that's what I did. And looking back, there was a time when I was looking back at all the case files that I wrote. So mm-hmm, I wrote like my own report after everything, and I reread it. And my first thought was, holy crap, my grammar is awful. that was my first thought. Second thought was, wow, I really believe this. I really thought like this was something true. This is just a noise down the hall. I didn't even investigate it because I was so scared, or I was worried, like, oh, I did the ghost hunting thing. I heard a noise or saw a shadow down the hall, and I waited. I didn't go down the hall to investigate it.
Was it because it was 2 a.m. and you were tired and you couldn't see because it was very dark?
Probably. There were many nights like that, like 2-3 in the morning, and you're kind of sitting there in a dark hallway and you're nodding off, you know, and you can't tell what's real and what's a dream.
Yeah, I do always love when it's like the beginning of the episode is like, yeah, so during the lunch shift, we were in the back washing dishes and there was the ghost. Or, you know, in the afternoon, my daughter was playing out by the tree and there was the ghost. And so, of course, since the claims all happened during the day, you must go investigate in the middle of the night.
Yes.
When it is pitch black. And right. You cannot see. Because that makes sense. Replicate the conditions of the right. Yeah, right? That makes sense.
It's spooky. You know, that's spooky nature. You need that. That's something I didn't realize either when I was still a ghost hunter. I didn't realize the concept of investigating under the same conditions. Mm-hmm. It was, I was just at this place. Why can't I just be at the place and have things happen? So the concept wasn't in my head yet. I just figured, well, you know, if something happened on a Wednesday at 10 a.m. in broad daylight with a whole bunch of people around, then what's the difference between that and me going there at midnight with the lights off? Because you have to turn the lights off, and just by myself with a camera. What's the difference? There isn't. Nah, it's the same, right? But no, it's not.
Fine.
It's very important.
I can't see anything and all of my senses are impaired, but fine.
Yeah. Now I'm freaking out at the slightest tap on the window or, you know, or breeze comes in and moves the curtains. I'm freaking out like, oh, that's a ghost. That's a ghost. That's totally a ghost. It has to be a ghost because this place is haunted. I've read about it. It's in books. It's on TV. That curtain moving, definitely a ghost.
I want to come back to something that you talked about because I think that when people hear discussions like the one that we're having, they keep it in the realm of ghosts and magic and spirituality, et cetera. And I'm glad that you brought up the concept of just sort of foundational beliefs as a concept and talking about the kinds of beliefs and the kinds of structure that you were raised in, generally speaking, because when you're a cisgender, heterosexual, white person, there's a bunch of stuff that you don't see, you don't consider, and you don't realize. And I think that a lot of people don't realize that poking at foundational beliefs is important because these are used for more than just magical thinking. They have been used to subjugate people of color. They have been used to legitimize slavery and racism. They have been used to legitimize homophobia and transphobia and all sorts of things that people in this country are still combating. So it's important to have skepticism of beliefs for the sake of believing them. Why do we believe this? Because it's not just the ghost in your closet. It's not just the spooky demon in your attic. It's, okay, well, if parts of this can be wrong, what does that mean for the other parts of these foundational beliefs? You know, these little lies that we tell ourselves so that we can ignore the very big lies that we're telling ourselves about, I am a better person than you because this book said so, or because my preacher said so, or because I was raised in a community that told me that I was better and that you are less than me. You are unclean. You are unworthy. You are a sinful person. So talk to me a little bit about what it felt like to poke at some of those foundational beliefs as you, were there any other kinds of societal or cultural beliefs that as you sort of broke free from magical thinking, that also went away? Maybe not.
Well, you know what? I mean, you're right. You're right. When you're growing up, and I mean, I grew up a white male, obviously, but I grew up in a community that was primarily white, primarily religious, Catholic, and you don't get too much exposure, especially without the internet. So I couldn't reach out to the outside world. Basically, I grew up in an area that was sheltered. It was sheltered, basically. And I didn't have exposure to other beliefs, other concepts, other ideas. So growing up, I knew what I knew because that's the way I was raised. And dare I say programmed, because you're programmed. That's it. You're brainwashed from the beginning to believe a certain way, to think a certain way, not thinking for yourself, because, you know, that there, the beliefs are the rules. Like, you had to go to church, you had to pray, you had to, every Sunday you had to go, you had to do the whole sit, stand, kneel, sit, stand, kneel, sit, stand, kneel bullshit. Oh my God, I hated that.
Did you all also have the kneelers where they fold down?
Yeah.
That's something.
I gradually evolved to the slightly on the edge of my butt on the pew where I wasn't actually kneeling.
Like you're kneeling, but you're not. Yeah.
Absolutely.
Yeah. I figured that one out too.
But you didn't get exposed to these other ideas and concepts. And it is difficult. It's scary because you start seeing something different. And one of the things that I, at least in Catholicism that I grew up in, was that other people that followed different beliefs were wrong. They were just wrong. And they need to be saved. And growing up with that, it sounded okay. But when you start reevaluating yourself, when you start questioning and realizing, okay, you know, am I doing something wrong? Like, am I looking at this wrong? Why is this person bad just because they're different? Why? Is there a reason behind it? Is it just belief? Why is the belief saying that this person is bad? That doesn't make sense to me now. So now I have to look at it. And that's, I think that's when it started breaking away. You know, like, I had a friend, and this is, I hope this doesn't come off bad, but I went to my high school.
Get the whipping stick if it's bad. It's okay.
Well, no, I mean, this is just coming from my perspective, and I'm trying to relate it. And unfortunately, nowadays, I really don't know what's offensive anymore. It's very confusing to me. So, but I grew up, I went to a Catholic high school. There was one black kid. He was my buddy. And I couldn't understand why he was the only one. Like, where is everyone else? Where are the people of different colors? Where is everyone? Why is it 99.9% white people in my school? What's going on? And it was just a strange concept. And that really started the wheels turning and questioning the religion too. Like, why is it like this? Why am I constantly told that that person is going to go to hell because they don't believe in our God? Why? Or why is that person going to hell because they don't like women when they're supposed to like women? Like, why? Who said they're supposed to like women? I'm watching nature shows on WHYY that show, like, other races of other species on this planet. The males and females get together with each other. Like, why are they doing it, but they're not going to hell? Why are people not going to hell? I don't understand it. So this made me question pretty much everything and reevaluate myself to say, am I judging people based on what someone else said? And I think that's what a lot of today's people need to realize. You're judging people off of what someone else said or some fictional character said from thousands of years ago. You know, don't base it on that. Judge people by who the people are. You know, if they're good people, it's not your fucking business what they do with their private lives or what they believe. It's not. You know, if they're not hurting you, so be it.
Yeah, I think that people get really hung up, especially in conversations like ours, because it, you know, it'll probably be marketed and promoted as, you know, Debunker comes on to talk about, you know, debunking ghost hunting and paranormal investigation and yada yada. But the thing is, I think that people forget that there is a bigger conversation. There is a larger nebula of beliefs, and all of these things are interconnected. All of this kind of, I mean, it is an entire set of beliefs. It's not just one or two that are being pulled out. It's not just ghosts. It's not just demons. It's not just aliens. It's a set. It is a cultural way of viewing the world and of viewing yourself and of viewing your in-group versus your out-group. And I think that it's important to have the conversation that it is okay to poke at belief, generally speaking, because if you don't, then you don't necessarily know whether or not some of those beliefs come from a harmful place, or whether they are unwittingly causing you to do harm, whether or not you meant to do it or not, because of right. the way that you were, you thought you were doing right.
Or maybe you thought, like growing up, and I know I've made jokes when I was little that were wrong. They were either racist or homophobic or what have you. They were wrong, but in the environment that I was in, I didn't realize that I was being offensive. I didn't realize I was doing something wrong or saying something wrong. I didn't realize that I was hurting people that might hear what I had to say and got pissed off. Mm-hmm. I didn't realize that until I finally stopped and looked at myself and said, I said this. Is that why? Why did I say that? Because my friends were saying it, or mm-hmm. other people were saying it, and generations before me were saying it to me. And I was like, no, this is wrong. This mm-hmm. has got to stop. I got to stop this. And you got to change yourself. And again, reevaluate yourself. Are you believing something just because somebody else told you to believe that? Think for yourself. That's the general lesson, I think. Think for yourself and really decide, like, Are you just being an asshole? You know, you really, because yeah, you are. if you're making fun of people because they look different, they think different, they do different things than you, if that's the only reasons, you're an asshole. Mm-hmm. If you're making fun of them.
Do you think that?
Did that sound good? I mean, I'm not, again, like I'm always thinking, like, am I saying it right? Am I
think that when people come from a genuine place, other folks, marginalized communities especially, understand when someone's coming from a genuine place. Okay. Do you think, sort of turning back to the topic at hand, do you think that science and the scientific method have a place in spirituality?
I've always seen them clash. Mm-hmm. Because you have spirituality, which is faith-based. It really is. It's beliefs versus something that's hardcore and fact-based, you know? So it depends on what you mean by spirituality. Like, mm-hmm. is it, cause you can talk about one version where it's like, oh, I believe in ghosts in the afterlife and gods and angels and demons and stuff like that. But there's also that more meditative kind of finding my inner peace spirituality. Mm-hmm. Like when I go to Gettysburg, Pennsylvania, and I sit, there's a place on Little Round Top where you can sit there at the sunset and you watch the sunset across the battlefields. And it's the most beautiful thing I usually ever see, you know, and I can sit there for the 10 to 15 minutes and I feel that, like, one with the universe kind of feeling, you know. I'm not saying I'm communing with the afterlife, but I feel at peace. Mm-hmm. You know, it's quiet. Everyone's respectful, mostly because there's signs up telling you to be quiet, be respectful. But I feel that. So for me, that's spirituality. You know, that's me relaxing and listening to the world around me. So that to me is what you're talking about on that side. Mm-hmm. But then again, when you're talking about people that want to believe in ghosts and demons that are visiting them, it's still early, sorry. then there's that clash with science, because I am science minded. I am on that side where it's like, all right, if you're saying this, where's the proof? Where's the facts? Where's the evidence? Where's the data that we can collect and analyze? You know, that's my mindset. So I don't know if they're ever going to mesh. I think they're always going to be butting heads, because again, with the version of spirituality that we're talking about here, it's belief-based versus something that's fact-based, and they're not going to blend. I don't think so.
So there is a large part of paranormal investigation and ghost hunting and Bigfoot sightings and all of that, that's just kind of fun. It's fun. I mean, it's just fun. I mean, you know, going and finding a ghost on its surface, there's just some fun to it. I mean, gosh, you know, it was a fun Friday night. I've been on plenty of ghost hunts. I don't know that I've ever found a ghost, but I've had a lot of fun going on those. But there's, of course, another side to spiritual claims. When people start making claims and, you know, claiming that they can do things or claiming that they can perform certain feats or put you in communication with dead ancestors, et cetera, you know, that kind of thing. From your perspective in your career, as it were, on your side of the fence, what is the harm of using the trappings of science to make some of these claims without allowing for falsifiability?
So I guess what you mean is like, what's the harm with these beliefs?
What is the potential for harm here? Like so, you know, ghost hunters, the average ghost hunter, you know, what is the potential for harm there?
So the potential for harm is, well, for one example, if they go into a private residence and they do their investigation and they tell the homeowners, you have a demon, you have a demonic presence. So the harm here can be a few things. It causes anxiety because now the people that live in that house who called these ghost hunters to come out, they see the ghost hunters as an authority. Because they're calling them in, they're seeing them as experts and saying, come in, I have weird stuff happening in my house. Please tell me what's going on. So you have this team of people come in with their matching bowling shirts and they have their equipment and they're like, well, we think that you have a demonic presence or something evil here. And that's why things are flying off the shelves and you're getting bad smells. So that's causing anxiety. And that's going to cause sleepless nights. That's going to cause people to panic and not want to come home. They're going to stay out. They're going to look for someplace else to live. You could cause financial troubles because if someone's stuck because they can't afford, they might take out another loan. They're going to put themselves in deeper debt because they have to get out of the house because you told them it was demonically possessed or infested. And now they're scared shitless and they need to get out. There may be sleepless nights where they hear something bang against the window. I mean, what if a bird or even a bee, like I've seen the big bumblebees, like get totally confused by a window and start bouncing off of it. What if that happens and a child doesn't realize it and the child thinks, oh no, this is a demon coming to get me. Now they run out of the house or even a parent that wakes up in the middle of the night because they hear something outside. It might be just an animal, but they could now interpret that as demonic possession, and they're afraid to be possessed because they've seen all the Hollywood movies and the TV shows, and they don't want that to happen to them because it gets disgusting with the pea soup and stuff. So they want to run out, and they could run out at night. So sleepless nights, anxiety, financial loss. There's also the idea that, and this is something I've talked about recently, is these backwoods kind of exorcists that claim that somebody is possessed and they want to exorcise them because, you know, they want to get the demons out. And we've seen things really go bad. People were strained, broken bones, bruises, starvation, being starved because they don't give them food or water. They restrain them for days. And I mean, you can go into a website called What's the Harm? It's literally called What's the Harm? And read about these cases where families have tried to exorcise their kids or family members and end up killing them or maiming them or mentally damaging them so bad that it stays with them for the rest of their lives. So these are some of the dangers. This is some of the harm that can be done. Psychics that trap you in this vicious cycle of come back, you know, you either have a curse or if you want to talk to your loved one again, your son or daughter that passed away in that horrible car accident, if you want to come back, it's only, you know, $199 per hour if you come back, and that's financial loss. People have lost hundreds of thousands of dollars because they're convinced by this kind of stuff. And they spend all their money, they waste their savings, they waste everything, they take loans out in order to pay to have that continued communication. So when you ask what's the harm, there's a lot of harm. Mm-hmm. There's financial loss, there's mental illness, there's physical harm, there's death that can happen. And it may seem trivial to your average ghost hunter, but what the average ghost hunter needs to know is that when you walk into a private residence, you are viewed as an expert. You are viewed as an authority. They are looking at you and taking your word at law. So you have a huge responsibility. This mm-hmm. is not something you're just doing for reality TV. You're mm-hmm. influencing that family. You're influencing the decisions and the lifestyle of that family when you go in there and tell them what you interpret as results. So there's a lot of harm that can be done. And I think ghost hunters and paranormal investigators, whatever they want to call themselves at the time, when they go into a private residence, I think they should be held fully responsible for whatever happens to that family afterwards, based on their conclusions.
From what I can tell, in my time in this community and in my time sort of, you know, doing my own investigations and research into a lot of these different kinds of groups, there are basically two camps of people using different kinds of, you know, investigatory methods. There's the folks that are acting in good faith. A person they respect told them that this method worked, and so they continue from that basis. They are operating as an investigator in good faith. They think that what they are doing is, you know, good faith investigation of paranormal experiences, and they're not there trying to act predatory. Then there's those folks that are not acting in good faith. these folks understand that the equipment that they're using is not being used for its intended purpose. And they're specifically employing a lot of the methods that you said. You know, you're under a curse, you are possessed, you have a demon, there's a demon in your floorboards, et cetera. I mean, I've seen plenty of stories, we all have, of people losing their homes and losing their livelihoods and losing all sorts of stuff to these kinds of folks. In your experience, from your perspective, from your time in and around these communities, do you find this breakdown to be fairly true? Do you think there are good faith investigators out there? And if so, what percentage would you say, you know, in the average of the paranormal investigation community, what do you think is, you know, how many folks are out there acting in good faith rather than not? Is this a bad, basically, is this a few bad apples are ruining it for the bunch kind of thing?
I think it's a little bit more complicated than just is it a few bad apples? Mm-hmm. So I agree with your idea that, yeah, there's good faith and there's not so good faith, mm-hmm. con artists. So there's a lot, I think the majority of the paranormal community work in good faith. They are trying to help people. They want to help people. Mm-hmm. You know, they want to understand and maybe bring some ease to the family's fears. But the way they're going about it is just is not right. It's incorrect. And they want to go in, they have all this equipment that is never tested. It's never actually shown to do what they claim it does. So they're using a lot of equipment. They're getting these beeps and lights and stuff from these weird gadgets that are marketed directly to ghost hunters. And they're seeing that as signs of paranormal activity. They're saying, yes, we have evidence. There's something here. And that's where there's a problem, because they're most of the time they're misinterpreting the results, because either the equipment doesn't do what they claim it does, or they don't understand how to interpret the results. And therefore, they're interpreting it as they see on the TV shows, the reality ghost hunting shows. And they're giving a false impression of what's going on.
Yeah, there's a lot of armchair physicists out there.
Yes. Yes. Instead of researching it and trying to test it and really see what's going on, they are basing it off what they saw on TV. Mm-hmm. And therefore, passing along misinformation. And that's part of the problem. Mm-hmm. Even though they're acting in good faith, they're not acting in good methodology. Mm-hmm. So on the other side of that, there are the con artists. They know what they're doing. They know the stuff that they're using doesn't work. They're purposely interpreting results in favor of what will get them the most financial gain. And that can come in the form of TV time or TV show, more gigs that pay more, or just outright charging a customer or client to come back out and do readings over and over again. I think I wouldn't venture to guess a percentage because I really don't know. There's never been a study on this. I have no idea. In my personal observations, I think most of them act in good faith. They're really trying. The groups, even some of the psychics slash mediums that are out there, I think believe themselves to have some kind of ability, even though they're doing mostly cold reading. I think it's reinforcement from friends and family when they have just good intuition and they come up with right guesses talking to people. They get the idea, especially in a family or a circle of friends that believe in the paranormal. Someone's going to say, wow, you must be psychic, or you must be an empath. You know, you're getting these weird things, and, you know, that develops into a belief that someone's psychic.
And like you said earlier, you remember the hits and forget the misses.
Right. The confirmation bias kicks in and it reinforces that belief. And you just go with it. It builds over time until someone like me comes along and says, wait a minute, you're using this technique. And I can point it out every time you used it. But yeah, I don't know what the percentage is. I would think the bigger percentage, the larger percentage is people trying to do good. They're really trying. Whereas the percentage of people that are con artists that know what they're doing, they know they're taking advantage of clients and people and homeowners, is smaller. But how small? I don't know. Like, I wouldn't say it's 90-10. I don't know. I would,
sure,
because I do meet a lot of people that are actively conning people.
Sure. And absolutely. Sad. I mean, and you can't spend any time in this community and not see it. I think that just the general community, when you say it out loud, people are like, shh, don't acknowledge that.
Yeah.
Don't shh. And it's like, if we, the people who claim belief of any level in this, do admit that there are con artists in our community, but we don't say there's con artists in our community, then we're kind of like tacitly approving.
You're part of the problem.
We're tacitly abiding by the con artist.
Yes, yes, you
we're
are.
We're giving them our cred. They're getting to leech off of the good name of that, you know, not to use your made up statistic there, but let's pretend it's 90-10. They're the 10% are leeching off the goodwill of the 90%. And that's bad. Yeah. What is that?
90%.
There's a fallacy there, cloaked in something or other. I forget. But
the 90% is supporting the 10%.
Right. If we never acknowledge it, and if we never say no, this is actually happening, then yeah, you're tacitly approving it. You're tacitly abiding by it.
And I think there's a lot of people that are afraid to call out others, and because I get, and I'm not knocking them, but I do get a lot of contact, like emails, asking me, "Hey, have you looked into this person? Mm-hmm. Have you looked at, they're doing this, and I think they're conning people." Mm-hmm. And I get it. You know, I understand that they're taking steps to help call out somebody, but do it yourself. Like, this is your community. This is your community. These are your people you're protecting.
Exactly. Because, I mean, this is just basic sociological in-group, out-group dynamics to believers, to spiritual people. Spiritual people, you're in an out-group. I mean, you're someone that, you know, you are a skeptic, you debunk things quite frequently, et cetera, et cetera. So you saying, hey, this person's a fraud, isn't going to mean the same as if you hear it from a trusted source who you consider as part of your in-group. If you are a believer, if you're a spiritual person, and if you say that person over there is doing a fraud, it means more to your spiritual community than if an outsider were to come in and say it. So if we, spiritual people can acknowledge that this is happening, it will mean more. I mean, this isn't a house of cards. It's not like if you poke at this and you say, hey, this is crap. There's still plenty of other reasons to be here, but this is crap. It's not all going to fall down.
Right.
Like, that's what I think we think is going to happen. Like, if we start questioning anything at all ever, it's like, well, you can't question any part of this. You just have to accept all of this. You have to accept, you know, anything remotely new age, and you have to accept anything remotely this and that and the other, and you have to stick it all together, and you can't poke at any of it at all, or the entire thing falls apart. I'm like, no. And this is not a house of cards. This is not pie. And even if it were difference. Pie, you can always bake more pies.
Oh, I like pie. that's the difference between that community and science, the scientific community. The scientific community does question each other. Mm-hmm. They're not afraid to say no.
Peer review. Oh my God. Yeah. My kingdom for peer review in the spiritual community.
Yeah. Yeah. I mean, you really need to do it. They need to do it. They need to call themselves out. They need to police mm-hmm. themselves. You know, they really do. They need to say, hey, this is not right. We should look at this. We should question this. And don't be afraid to question. Just question it. What's going to happen? They're not going to be your friend anymore. Oh, boo hoo. I don't care. You know, because if they're conning people, you don't want them to be your friend anyway. Really? I mean, I don't understand what else you're trying to get out of it. What do you gain by being quiet? You know, if not speaking out against something like that. If you see somebody taking advantage of a family mm-hmm. and you're not saying anything, you're part of the problem. You really are. Mm-hmm. And don't come to me and say, hey, you know, you need to look at this person. Like, yeah, I might look at them, but you can also yeah, you can also turn around and look at them yourself.
Yep.
And, you know, preach to somebody saying, look, you know, I found this out. This is what happened. I don't think this is right. I have a problem with this. Speak your mind, get it out there. And I think the whole community would be better for it. I think mm-hmm. it would benefit from everyone like turning around and looking at themselves and looking at the people that are next to them. Stop protecting people that don't deserve protection. Just call them out when they need to be called out. And I think people will look at you differently. They will look at the community a little bit differently. I mean, they're not going to accept it with open arms right away, you know, because there's a lot of work to be done. But at least this is one more thing that's out of the way. It's like, all right, look, that community is starting to look at itself and starting to weed out the people they know are conning others. So that's a good thing.
Can I ask about some of the common methods of proof, of obtaining proof? I want to talk about ghost hunting equipment.
Okay. Like what in particular?
Yeah, I have a small list of some of the more common ghost hunting tools.
Okay.
And walk me through what it is that they claim that is being done with this, and if you know, what is actually being done with this thing.
Okay.
So, for example, an EVP, and I think that's what, electronic voice phenomenon, right?
Yes.
That's where
yes.
we record something. I'm sitting here giving the answer. So we record, we do audio recordings. You know, you see people do the digital tape record, digital audio recorder, and then you listen yes. back and you say, oh, there's a voice here.
Right. So that's what they claim is uh-huh. happening, that they're going into a place that they're communicating with ghosts or spirits or what have you, by asking questions, pausing, and then asking another question. And then when they're done, they replay the track and they listen for voices. Mm-hmm. So the issue with that, there's a ton of issues. There's always going to be a ton of issues with every piece of equipment they're using. First is the environment is not controlled, and that goes across the board. So let's put that as number one for every tool that you're going to bring up. The environment is not controlled. You're not blocking sound from the upper lower floors. You're not blocking sound from the hallway or other rooms or outside, or even from the ghost hunters that are in the room with it. You're not blocking any of the sound. Sometimes it's handheld. Sometimes you're holding it in your hand, and the friction from your hand or from your fingers as it moves goes across the body of the recorder the microphone is attached to the body of the recorder and therefore picks up that those small, subtle vibrations, and it causes weird distortions that will be interpreted as voices or responses. Sometimes demonic because it sounds like a growl. You have issues of, what else is there? Whispering. People whispering and talking. I can't tell you how many times that someone has been recording a session and you hear people talking in the background, and other recordings or video cameras will show teammates talking, yet one person will have a recording to say, well, no, that wasn't at that time, or I'm 100% sure it wasn't those people talking. But you can't be sure. Mm-hmm. That's the problem. You're dealing with an audio track. You can't be sure who is talking and who is not talking unless you sync it up. But they never want to do that. I usually ask, like, hey, do you have a video of the same thing? If you do, can I have it? Can we sync it up and see, you know, who is talking at the same time? No, that's too far. That's a lot of work. So most of the time they don't want to do it. And basically there's just no control. You put out a recorder and you ask questions, and no one else is like taking another recording. No one else is documenting it or taking notes. And it's just all over the place. And when you get the results, when you get these alleged EVPs, priming becomes an issue. Mm-hmm. So like when you see reality shows and they're like, oh, we're going to play this sound clip that we have. And as soon as they switch to the sound clip, the words are up on the screen. And you're like, oh, you look down, you read it, and that's what you hear. Of course, yep. That's what you're going to hear. That's a big problem.
It's like those sounds where it's just a sound, but it's like, if you read this side of the screen, it sounds like this. And yes. If you read this side of the screen, it sounds like that. And I don't think people realize that, oh, that's a fun, neat trick on the internet.
Yeah.
Oh, wait.
That's real life. That's really what's going on.
That's how this other thing works, too.
Yep. Because I've done a few times I've gone to conferences when I set up and I've had a recording, and I play it for people and I had them write it down, like write mm-hmm. down what they heard, and no one hears the same thing.
Mm-hmm.
And that's the big,
but if you tell someone what to hear,
yes.
Yeah. Suddenly everybody's like, yeah, I hear that.
I hear. Yeah. That's amazing. Yeah. That's a good catch. Good catch. Wow. But that's a problem because there's no control over this. It's pretty much, if I tell you what to listen for, that's what you're going to hear. And that's not scientific. That's manipulation. That's what it comes down to. So EVPs are just, they're not good. They're horrible. And I don't trust them because when you ask them what was going on at the time, they're like, wow, were you just standing around, you know, asking questions? Okay. Did you soundproof the room? Were there people in other parts of the house? Well, yeah, but they weren't talking. How do I know that? You know, like, these are all questions. Questioning everything is important. It's really important because you need to ask these questions. Were there other people? Did you whisper? Did anyone fart? Did your stomach growl? Because these are things that happen.
Mm-hmm.
And I mean, you have to account. You have to take notes. No one takes notes. I all the ghost hunters that I've met, none of them take notes. I'm the only one. I literally bring a clipboard with me with a checklist of things, of like all the devices that are possibly used, what they're doing with it, how they're using it. Are they using it correctly? Are they interpreting the results right there? Are they waiting till later? I take tons of notes while I'm there, but never have I been on a ghost hunt where I saw ghost hunters taking notes. It's all done days or weeks later when it's well after the fact. And what's the use? You're trying to remember something that happened days ago when I think you touched on it earlier, where it's like 2 a.m. and you're half asleep and you're trying to remember exact details of what happened. No, that's not how it works. And it's not going to work. So yeah, EVPs, I don't put any stock into.
What's an EMF meter?
Piece of shit.
Sorry. So, and I should qualify here because I actually use EMF meters as an example in my book. What are the EMF meters that ghost hunters use?
So they use
because they're different.
Okay. So EMF meters stands for electronic electromagnetic field. meters. So they read mostly household current. Most of them are calibrated to 50 to 60 hertz, which is mains current, your house current. And it reads the field that's coming off of it. It reads the strength of the field. That's important. That's important to differentiate because it's reading the strength of the field, not the frequency, which is a different thing. And the idea is that ghosts give off EMF. I don't know where this concept came from. I've dug for years trying to figure out where this
was. Was it Ghostbusters? I feel like it was Ghostbusters.
It was probably, you know what? Ghostbusters really inspired a lot. It really did. With the PK meter, that really started off. And that's probably the origin of using an EMF meter is Ghostbusters. But the concept of a ghost or spirit producing or manipulating electromagnetic fields, I'm not sure where that concept started. But that's the tribal knowledge that we're dealt. So using EMF meters is a way for ghost hunters to say, look, I'm in this room and for some reason the needle went up or the digital gauge, the digital readout spiked. And I don't know why. It's unexplainable. Therefore, ghost, which is very, very unscientific. refer to our last conversation. Rule number one is that there are no environmental controls whatsoever. EMF meters, also the cheaper versions, which is the most common that we get with ghost hunting, are single axis meters. Mm-hmm. So they only read one axis at a time. There are three axes that you can rotate this on. And no one rotates these meters on all three axes. They walk in with the EMF meter in hand, and they walk around the room, point it in one direction. They don't rotate it at all. And they take the readings that they see, and that's it. That's the reading. And they don't realize that that reading is completely inaccurate. It really is. I feel sorry for ghost hunters to do this. I really do, because they're wasting their time. And usually it's like 20 minutes or a half hour before their ghost hunt starts that they're all doing this, and they're just wasting that time.
And I mentioned the ones that a lot of ghost hunters use because you brought up the fact that a lot of the EMF meters that are out there in these like ghost hunting kits that people are charging tons of money for are actually like these really, really cheap EMF meters that can go off by like the camera equipment, your phone, a dormant electrical outlet. I mean, just like it can go off by just about anything. And if you've got a room filled with other types of electronic paraphernalia and camera equipment, and you've got a phone and you've got a phone and you've got a phone, we've all got flashlights and there's plugs in the room, like, and a junk EMF meter went off, I'd be surprised if it didn't.
Right. I mean, the K2 meter, which is the popular one, or it used to be a popular one, that was very sensitive. And I was introduced to that many years ago, right after it first debuted on Ghost Hunters. And Chris Fleming was the guy that was promoting it. He was promoting them and selling them. And I met him in a conference in Louisville, Kentucky. And I was actually sitting at a table next to him. And I was looking at him and we had a conversation. And he's holding the button in and it's on. And we're in this big conference hall. And you hear the air conditioning kick on because you have that deep, like, boom. Mm-hmm. You hear that boom. You feel it. And the meter went up. It spiked. And I was like, you got to be kidding me. Like, how do you expect to use this as a valid scientific instrument if you were in this conference hall, nowhere near the AC system, yet when it kicked on, that went off? Mm-hmm. If you weren't paying attention, if there was some other noise or someone's talking to you and you really weren't paying attention, you totally missed that low thump that you hear when it kicked on, and you would get this spike. How do you tell?
I don't know what you're talking about, Kenny. Dead people want to go to conventions too.
I know. I stand corrected. They're all around us. They're always here. So the meter should be going off all the freaking time.
Okay. This next one, I'm going to be real honest. I hope that you know why they use it, because I'm still pretty unclear. I've been on ghost hunts where they use this one, and I still wasn't quite clear why they were using it, because I thought this was just for Christmas. It's the LED light array. You know, those big castings of LED lights? No, is that's not familiar to you?
I've seen just LED panels like used for video enhancement, but
see, the people will get those like Christmas light LED light arrays that like put up a ton of points of light all over a wall or in a space or something like that.
The laser pointers.
Yeah.
Okay.
But that, it does like yeah, a ton of them all at once, like a big wall of them.
Okay. So the idea that I'm familiar with is that this, you turn the lights out, you turn these things on, they shoot the, it's laser light. So they put a grid up on the wall.
Right.
And the idea is that if a shadow person, a shadow figure walks through the scene, it will block the light and you'll be able to see it. The incredibly flawed reasoning with this is that if a shadow figure exists, let's just, you know, throw it in there and let's go with the concept. If it is real and it's going to walk by and block the light from the lasers, which is visible light. All right, everyone stay with me here. Then it's not a far reach to say, if you turn the fucking light on in the room, it will also block that visible light. The concept is just, it's visible light. So if you turn the light bulb on, the lights that I have here, the lights that you have on you right now, same concept. If you can block the visible light of the laser pen or the grids that they put up, then it should also block the light from LEDs, light bulbs, incandescent bulbs. It's the same concept. There is no reason to turn the lights off, turn the grid on, to make the whole environment harder for you to observe what's going on. It's a ridiculous concept. And I, as soon as the first laser pens came out, where they were putting them on the little tripods and doing the same thing, I brought that up. Like, what's the point? Why are you turning the lights out? It doesn't make any sense. You're just, all you're doing is making it harder for yourself. But I will admit, it makes it look spooky on TV. That's it. That's the only benefit I can see from it.
Infrared, just generally. I see a lot of paranormal investigation shows are like, oh, we're going to go switch to infrared. Because, of course, we're doing this at 3 a.m. and there's no light. What's infrared and also the thermal cameras as well? What's going on with those?
These are cool for TV. Basically, infrared makes it spooky because then you switch to night vision cameras and everything is in black and white or that eerie green color. So it makes it
spooky. Zach Bagans loves himself some infrared.
Well, yeah. Zach Bagans loves himself.
That's the tagline for the episode.
The idea behind that first thing, IR, is that some ghost hunters believe that ghosts and spirits can reflect infrared light. I don't know where this concept came from, except that when Sony came out with their night shot camera for the first time, it was like, this is something new. This is cool. We can see in the dark. Ooh, you know, they start catching different shadows or weird anomalies in videos. So therefore, that quickly translated into, this is good for paranormal because they're catching paranormal activity, obviously. When it was just strange artifacts, it's a new light. It's a different kind of light medium that we're not used to. You know, we can't see in the infrared, but with this camera, we can. But we also have to remember that the camera is treating infrared light just like visible light. It's a slightly different wavelength. It's a little longer, but it's still treating it like light. So you're still going to have reflections. You're still going to have shadows cast by infrared light, especially when you're using like the onboard infrared light on the camera and then a light panel over here. You're going to have shadows and reflections and lens flare because of that. You're not going to see it with your eyes, but you're going to see it in the camera. So it creates this weird stuff. Therefore, it became really popular because it was anomalies. And unfortunately, a lot of ghost hunting is anomaly hunting. You're looking for weird stuff. You're not trying to explain it. You're just looking for weird shit to put on TV or your website. When it comes to thermal imaging, almost the same concept. It's a different way to view the world, and it's colors. It's a whole bunch of colors. So it looks creepy, especially when you don't put it next to a visible light interpretation. You can't tell what you're looking at. It's looking at different temperatures and assigning colors to them, different color tones to the different temperatures. What you need to pay attention to is the color scale that's on the side. It's always on the side. It's usually on the right side of the screen, and that changes. That's the important thing. You have to understand that it changes when it calibrates to different areas. So if I'm looking at the screen in front of me, it's going to calibrate to the screen. But if I turn around and go over here, it's going to calibrate to my shelves over here. So it's going to be a different one. That scale can go from like a 20 or 30 degree range to a 5 degree range, all with the same colors. So you have to pay attention to that. That's a big deal.
I didn't know that that's what was happening. I didn't realize that it changed. I thought it was just like this blue means this and red means this temperature. I didn't realize that those measurements changed.
Yeah. You could have.
I think a lot of people don't know that that happens.
Yeah. I mean, every time I've gone out with somebody that had one, and I've pointed it out, they're like, "What do you mean it changes?" I'm like, you got to be kidding me. First of all, you should never take equipment out if you don't know how to use it.
And the scene is always this. They say, look over there, and then you're looking somewhere, and then you switch really fast. And sure, you might see a temporary spot. And then it goes away.
Yeah. Well, when it recalibrates.
And I guess the reason there is it goes away because it's now calibrated to the new spot.
Right. And then it shifts all the colors to reflect the new temperature scale.
I had no idea.
It's really, really important. And something with that is always not only pay attention to the scale, but pay attention when they edit that out. That's a big telltale sign. That's a red flag for me. When they edit out the scale and you can't see now what the colors mean, because literally, like, you could have you tend to think blue is cold and red is hot and white is like as hot as you can get.
Yeah.
So if you take red and blue, sometimes there's a 20 degree difference, but sometimes there's a 2 degree difference, you know, and that's a big deal.
It is like
your eyes are blowing up. It is a big deal because that's a difference between like walking through a scene, and if I just get near something, my body heat
sure
can take something down a degree.
Was somebody just leaning on that wall? Were they standing too close to that wall? And then they moved to say, look over there. And then, my gosh.
Yeah, that happens a lot. So that's definitely something to pay attention to. And that's why it's a good tool for finding air leaks, water leaks, places and machinery that are overheating. Yes, it's great for that. But when it comes to ghost hunting, there's no concept behind why we use it, except that it's something different. It's something strange and it looks cool on TV, but does it pick up ghosts? I don't know. You know, if I see a strange blob in a room, what does that mean? It's different temperature. That's it. That's all it means. There's something there that's a different temperature. I don't know if someone leaned against that wall and walked away, or if there's machinery on the other side or something. Like, you can look at a floor, and if there's a room below you with regular lights on, like incandescent lights, that will heat up that spot of the floor. So when you look down, you're like, oh my gosh, there's a hot spot there. What's going on there? I don't know. No one was in this room. There shouldn't be any heat at all. But yeah, there is, because it's seeing the heat coming from the light below the floor, which is only like 6 inches or you know, 8 inches below it, that's generating that heat. So much that is involved with using these tools that I think ghost hunters just overlook because of the novelty of the item. You know, like, it looks cool. It looks really neat. And, you know, I play with them.
So, but speaking of items with a lot of novelty, I'd like to ask you about one that has practically no novelty because everybody has one. The Lucent flashlight. You take the flashlight, you unscrew it.
Oh my God.
And then you set it on a surface and you say, oh, if you're here, make the light turn off. If you're here, make the light turn on. What's going on there?
That's called science and magic tricks. So that is, wow. First, I mean, you actually nailed it in your description. When you unscrew the head, you are manipulating the device. You're not turning it on and getting it ready to measure or react to something. You are literally manipulating it because you have to get that sweet spot where it's just on. And that's it. You're twisting the head. So it's a mag light. It's a it's one of the older mag light with the regular bulbs, not the LED bulbs. But you're getting the regular bulbs that heat up. And do I have one here? I was just looking. I thought I had one. No, I don't. Okay. So basically, you unscrew until the light turns on, and you start going back and forth until it literally, like, it's kind of almost blinking
right there,
but it's kind of blinking.
Yep.
So when it stays on, it starts heating up the inside of the lens. The plastic reflector that's inside of it heats up. And when it does that, it expands. And as you know, like, there's no on and off switch on these flashlights. It is by the head being screwed on and off, which compresses a spring or decompresses a spring, and that activates the circuit. So when it heats up, when this reflector heats up, it actually pushes against the spring and it opens the circuit. So, and that's the equivalent of turning the head down. So the light goes out. As the reflector cools, it compresses and it makes contact again, and it turns the light on. So you have this cycle that keeps going. This is just science. This is basic science. And ghost hunters put these flashlights up sometimes one, sometimes two. And they're like, oh, if you're a male, turn this one on. If you're a female, turn this one on. And they wait. Or they ask the same question over and over again until one of them turns on or off. I love that, because that's just waiting for something to happen. But if you sit there in a location, and I've done this, I've done it here. I've had them set up on my desk, but a camera right here. And I did a video on this where I didn't touch them. I left three of them on, and they just cycle on and off the entire time as I'm sitting here working different stuff. Doesn't have to be a ghost. You don't have to invoke anything supernatural. It is a trick, plain and simple. And I laugh when I see TV shows still using this.
I don't know, Kenny. I feel like you're ignoring the very real true fact that every single flashlight contains a dead person's spirit. That's,
I mean, obviously.
Why are you denying ghost flashlight rights? That's just,
it's, you know what? The battery is bigoted. The energy.
Yep.
The spirit that you shove into
batteries are just body. Dead people, man. Yes, they're just dead people.
Obviously.
Something with a lot of novelty. And the last thing on my list is the spirit box. This seems to have come into prominence in the last several years. What is it?
Piece of crap. So the spirit box is basically, it can be a couple things. The main definition is that it's a broken radio. Mm-hmm. It's a radio that has been modified so that it cycles through the AM and or FM stations at either one rate or different rates of speed. So it just cycles through them. And anyone that's been in an older car or had like a old radio box, boom box kind of thing, and you know there's a dial on it that you can go back and forth to tune in the stations. Us old people used to, all the time, we had to do that. That's basically what it's doing. You're just cycling through or sweeping through the stations, and it's drawing in terrestrial broadcasts, meaning you're getting all the radio stations in your area, including news broadcasts, commercials from anything, furniture, food, services, Amazon. You're getting toys. You're getting kids. You're getting drugs and drug reactions. You're getting all these commercials that are coming through. So when this spirit box cycles through these stations, there is also bleed over. So like a 102.1 frequency, you tune to that, you get the station in here, that's perfect, you hear it. But 102.0, 102.2, you still get bleed over. Going a little further, 102.3 and 101.9, you're getting bleed over. So it's possible to get two or three or four words out of that station from the bleed over. So the idea, the concept is that people are asking questions of ghosts and spirits, and they're waiting, they're listening to this radio as it sweeps through the stations to give a response. And they wait for a particular response. So if they ask, like, what's your favorite color? They're waiting for a color. if they hear something like Frank or chair, that doesn't answer their question. Mm-hmm. And there's two ways that can go. They can either ignore it and wait for something that sounds like a color, or more commonly, I hear they change the conversation. They hear Frank and they're like, well, wait, is that your name? Is that the name of the ghost? So it completely ignores the question that they asked and they go with a different answer, change the conversation altogether. Are they communicating with ghosts? No. They are talking to a radio that is receiving radio stations that are being broadcast that you can listen to on any radio, and they're interpreting these broadcasts as a response to their question. So that's the basic idea and the concept.
Now, there's a spirit box on steroids that started to become pretty popular in recent years, isn't there? Where you, with the goggles and the headphones and
Estes method, yes. So all that is doing is putting one person in the middle. So now you're dealing with a middleman. There was one person with headphones that's listening to the ghost box or the spirit box, mm-hmm. cycle through the radio stations, and they are picking out stuff that they can pick out. So again, imagine listening to all these stations and you're going through the radio dial, you're scanning through and you're listening for anything that you can hear, you know, that you can make out. If words come across, you just say them. And that's supposed to be like, I'm not sure what the real idea is behind it, but more or less, I think it's almost treated like a filter, mm-hmm. where other ghost hunters are asking questions and they're waiting for the person that with the headphones on to say something and interpret what they're hearing. So it's basically the same thing. I mean, if you take the headphones out, everyone would hear probably the same words, maybe interpreted them different, but does it work? There's a lot of flaws with this. And I also wrote about this. I did an article on this where the headphones that they're using are not noise canceling headphones. So they're you can put them on. And if you have like enough facial hair or hair up here, you're not sealed. So you can hear what's going on around you. So you can hear the questions. And unfortunately, I think there's probably some, if not a lot, of purposeful answers that come through. Like, you know what the question is, you know what they're waiting for, and you're listening for that. You're primed to listen for an answer to that specific question. But even so, you're just spitting out what you hear on the radio, and then the other ghost hunters are interpreting what you hear, what you think you hear from the radio, and saying, oh, how does this apply to our questions? And again, you're stuck with, does it actually answer the question or is it something else? And you're just going with whatever answers come across, you know, because we can build a story from you just throwing out random words at me. I mean, we can build a narrative from that. And especially if you're a good writer or a storyteller, we can build a really good story from it. And I think ghost hunters have been on enough ghost hunts and read enough ghost stories that they can do it. Even if they're not doing it intentionally, they're doing that.
Kenny, I want to be respectful of your time. I know we're coming up on quite a bit of time together. So I want to ask you one final question before I let you go. Is there a cryptid that you would be relieved to find out doesn't exist? And conversely, is there a cryptid you would be excited to find out does actually exist?
Wow. So I guess the cryptid I would not want to exist would be... what is that called? It's a pterodactyl. There's a like a modern day pterodactyl.
The gliders.
Yes.
So yes. Was it super glider or something like that? Something gliders. So,
yeah.
Yes.
I would not want that because that's something like you're hiking in the woods or in the mountains and you're not going to see that shit coming. You know, all of a sudden you get these like 6-inch talons into your shoulders and you're flying away and you're like, what the hell happened? You know, what am I doing up here? I that would just suck. That would suck. That would be the worst. I don't want that to happen. I would rather roll up onto a Bigfoot on a path because at least I know I have a chance. I have a chance to outrun it, you know, or if I'm running along a path, I can go off the path or I can throw things and I can grab a stick and try and fight. That pterodactyl thing, nope. That's like, you're just minding your own business and all of a sudden... plucked out of the sky. So no, that's the one I would not want. The one I would like to be real, Man, I would love the Loch Ness Monster to be real. That would be so cool.
Yeah.
That would be so cool. Like Bigfoot, it's usually, that's probably like the obvious choice.
Sure.
But that wouldn't be as big of a deal to me. It's like, all right.
I think it would make Chuck Tingle pretty happy, but.
Well, yeah. Yeah. But yeah, something like a leftover dinosaur.
Sure.
Would just be, that would be incredible because that would be just such a look into the past. That's a blast from the past. Literally, like, wow, this is a real dinosaur. Wow. Let's study it. Don't kill it. Let's study it. Let's swim alongside of it. And, you know, let's look at it and see what it does and what it looks like. And wow, that's really cool. So there you go. That's my answer.
Well, Kenny Biddle, I appreciate you spending some time here with me today. If folks want to find out more about you, get in touch with you in some kind of way, how can they do that?
So you can find me, I'm pretty much everywhere. I'm on social media, Facebook at I Am Kenny Biddle. That's my blog page. I'm on Twitter at Kenny Biddle 42. I am on TikTok at Kenny Biddle 42. And also Kenny's Mystery Museum, where I showcase a lot of allegedly haunted stuff people have given me. That's a cool thing. That's a whole nother show. And then what else? You can find my articles on skepticalinquirer.org. I have 40 some articles up there ranging from all kind of different paranormal claims. And then I do a podcast on Friday nights called the Skeptical Help Bar at 9 p.m. Eastern. I stream it to my YouTube channel, which is Kenny Biddle. Yeah, just Kenny Biddle. I'm trying to organize all these names in my head. And I also stream it to the Facebook page. I Am Kenny Biddle. And then I do Saturday nights at 8 p.m. Eastern. I do Three Tortured Souls podcast. Both are live streams. And so it's visual. You could see us and we talk about different topics, paranormal topics from skeptical or science point of views. And it's really, really fun. And yeah, that's about it right now.
Well, thank you so much for being here. Good luck at your next psychic fair, at your next paranormal gathering. Awesome. I hope that you remember your face shields and all of your tarps.
Yes. Yes.
Thanks so much for being here. You have a good rest of your day.
Thank you very much.
Well, rioters, that's going to do it here for us today. Thank you so much once again to my guest, Kenneth Biddle. It was such a pleasure having you on. I know this was a long conversation, but I really think it'll be of value to the community at large. If you like the show and you want to support it, there are a number of ways to help. Consider liking and sharing the show on social media. You can also rate the show 5 stars on Apple Podcasts or wherever you download shows and leave a review. Really, 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 I promise, just a comment, a word, an emoji. They all work and help bump the show up in the algorithm. Trying to get a few comments in there as the show comes closer to the publishing date, which I'm going to mention up front here, the pub date for my upcoming book, The Dabbler's Guide to Witchcraft. If you are interested in pre-ordering, you can do so at bit.ly/dabblersguide. Help keep the show free and producing on a regular basis by chipping in whatever you can. You can buy me a coffee, which is a one-time donation of your choosing, at coffeeco-ko-fi.com/incitingariot, or join my Patreon on a monthly basis. Patrons receive additional audio and video content, as well as archived episodes. People ask me all the time, where's episodes 1 through 98? They are archived. They are very bad. You probably don't want to listen to them, but if you are desperate for some old bad hot takes, Patreon. That's where you can listen to it. You also get a private Discord server and monthly chats with special guests. You can sign up at patreon.com/incitingprojects. All other show notes, including ways to get in touch with Mr. Kenneth Biddle, are on the blog at incitingariot.com. You can email me, that's Firelight, F-I-R-E-L-Y-T-E, at incitingariot.com. And I'm on most forms of social media at incitingariot. Well, that is going to do it for me today. Thank you all so much for joining the show. I'm going to leave you, but as always, I will leave you with love and light, Firelight.
Protect your boats and recreational vehicles with FPP RV and Marine antifreeze. It has burst-proof protection down to negative 50 degrees, keeping you protected against freezing temperatures. Keep your winter worry-free with FPP ready-to-use RV and Marine antifreeze now at Menards. Menards. Visit us in-store or on Menards.com and shop our great selection of automotive products.